This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, September 27th, 2012. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, The Cure for Romanticism. In the 19th century, Lord Byron was extraordinarily famous in a way that's unimaginable for a poet to be famous today. He's even got his own adjective, Byronesque or Byronic, for his erratic, brooding, and adventurous ways. But when it comes to contemporary tastes, Byron is way down on the list of 19th century poets to read, after Wordsworth, Coleridge, Keats, and Shelley, not to mention Whitman, Baudelaire, and others. Joining me to make the case of why we should put Byron at the top of the list, in particular his great satire Don Juan, is Amit Majmudar. Amit is a novelist and poet whose work has appeared in Poetry Magazine, and he recently wrote about Don Juan for the Kenyon Review. He joins me from WOSU in Columbus, Ohio. Amit, you say that Don Juan is categorically unsurpassed in the language. What's the category, and what makes it unsurpassed?
If you divide poems in general into serious ones and unserious ones, as far as unserious poems go, I would rank Don Juan as probably, you know, top of my personal list. And all these lists in the end are personal.
So you say unserious, and by unserious you mean it's funny stuff. This is a comic
poem.
Yes,
absolutely.
And you also say that while the poem was a great corrective to Romanticism, it's also a corrective to 21st century verse. Explain that if you would.
Well, one of the major tendencies of our time is a tendency towards the portentous, elegiac, you know, the hushed, deep image and voice of a lot of contemporary poetry.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And what we have in Don Juan is a profoundly worldly poetry, a poetry that focuses on the pageantry of life, that is free to talk about contemporary politicians and the different ways that people live in different societies, whether – because, you know, Don Juan goes to Russia, he goes to Greece, he goes to Turkey, he goes to England, he goes to Spain. It is a poem that is very close to what novelists do and to what comic novelists do. And this is something that contemporary poetry, while it doesn't entirely lack it, it could certainly use more of it, in my opinion.
Tell us what Don Juan is about, and why is it called Don Juan instead of Don Juan, as I've been pronouncing it my entire life.
Yeah. Well, when you're reading Don Juan, the plot is almost secondary to the voice of the narrator. This guy is very much Byron's alter ego. I think he's one of the most fully realized comic characters in English poetry. He's unabashedly British, and he's so John Bull about it. He mispronounces the Spanish names with this over-the-top British accent. So Don Juan becomes Don Juan, and Dona Inez becomes Dona Inez. And we know this because Byron, as early as Canto 1, makes sure to use their names as rhyme words so that we know exactly how he is mispronouncing it.
Right.
The story itself of Don Juan is the well-known Don Juan story, where a young Spanish aristocrat has 1,001 amours, according to, you know, Mozart's Don Giovanni. And he ends up getting dragged down to hell by an irate statue. And what's interesting is that Byron mentions in Canto 1 how he intends to describe Don Juan's trip down to hell. And you can imagine Byron putting all his contemporaries there just like Dante. Only Byron would have done it with a grin. And the fact that he never lived to write it, it strikes me as one of the hugest losses to English poetry. It's pretty much on a par with the death of Keats for me.
So I asked you to pick out a few passages to give us a better sense of the poem. This will just be a little taster. So what have you got for us to begin with?
So I figured I'd skip around from Canto 1 to give people a taste of Byron's various moods and modes in the poem, because what sustains a poem this long is its heterogeneity, keeps it from being boring. One minute he's one way, another minute he's another way. And so here's an example where he segues from a high romantic description of a woman's beauty, which was the very thing that Byron's audience at the time expected from him. And then he just kind of segues into satirical verses on marriage and adultery that his audience would have considered scandalous at the time.
Let me just warn you, and I'll warn listeners as well, that I'm going to interrupt as we go along for clarification, sis.
Sure, no problem.
So go ahead.
Her eye, I'm very fond of handsome eyes, was large and dark, suppressing half its fire until she spoke. Then through its soft disguise flashed an expression more of pride than ire, and love than either. And there would arise a something in them which was not desire, but would have been perhaps, but for the soul which struggled through and chastened down the whole.
Now, let me stop you there, talking about the soul struggling through and chastened down the whole. It's a very clever use of the word chasten.
Absolutely.
It has the word chase and chase. It's like a schoolmarm suddenly rising up and repressing all sorts of amorous desires in this woman. Anyhow, carry on.
Her glossy hair was clustered o'er a brow, bright with intelligence and fair and smooth. Her eyebrow shape was like the aerial bow, her cheek all purple with the beam of youth, mounting at times to a transparent glow, as if her veins ran lightning. She, in sooth, possessed an air and grace by no means common, her stature tall. I hate a dumpy woman.
No, let me stop you again there. I never thought that dumpy was a word from the 19th century. And that's just...
I didn't know that either. And that's one of the wonderful things that you find out reading Byron, because he's so much more colloquial and so much more into language as people really speak it than Wordsworth or Keats or anybody. So you find all sorts of words like this and you realize that they spoke probably a lot more like we do.
Yeah. And so now he veers into a satire.
Right.
Adultery.
And his voice and his tone completely changed.
Yeah.
And he's really switching it up on his readers.
Go ahead.
Wedded she was some years, and to a man of 50, and such husbands are in plenty. And yet I think, instead of such a one, 'twere better to have two of 25, especially in countries near the sun. And now I think on it, mi vien in mente, ladies, even of the most uneasy virtue, prefer a spouse whose age is short of 30. 'Tis a sad thing, I cannot choose but say, and all the fault of that indecent son, who cannot leave alone our helpless clay, but will keep baking, broiling, burning on, that howsoever people fast and pray, the flesh is frail, and so the soul undone. What men call gallantry and God's adultery is much more common where the climate's sultry.
Now, that's the old stereotype.
Right. People, he's playing into the elite London audience's notion of the hot-blooded Spaniard, the hot-blooded Italian.
Yes.
Because when you come from a colder climate, you're somehow more moral and you're more likely to behave properly because you're wearing more clothes, presumably. And so, yeah, that stereotype actually goes back to Shakespeare and before. It actually goes back to Chaucer.
So he's just playing with it. He's not promoting it. He's just
absolutely.
Playing, yeah.
When he satirizes things in Don Juan, he's glancing over at British society the whole time. And so when he says that, oh, it's all the fault of that indecent son, it's almost as though he's saying, yeah, you guys do it too, you know?
Okay, let's hear another passage that you chose, and this one's also from Canto 1. Can you set it up for us?
Sure. It's about dull classical book learning and Christian sermonizing, the kind that was foisted on poor young Juan by his strict mother. And he's kind of describing Don Juan's moral education. So everything that he says here is the sort of stuff that British schoolboys were learning, but here it's Don Juan learning it. So no matter what they teach him, he ends up becoming Don Juan, you know? So this passage goes like this. His classic studies made a little puzzle because of filthy loves of gods and goddesses, who in the earlier ages raised a bustle but never put on pantaloons or bodices.
No, I have to stop you there because that's a really deliciously dirty little thing that he did there.
Yeah.
A bustle, you know, is a bustle when you're in a hurry, but it's also a thing in the back of a skirt to raise the butt. So to raise
yes.
a bustle suggests some sort of sexual act about to take place.
Absolutely. And he's also talking about how classical literature was kind of sanitized for the consumption of the young.
Right.
Because there is a lot of really over-the-top un-Christian stuff in classical literature,
yeah.
Which he gets to a little bit later, that isn't something that proper British schoolmarms want their students learning about.
Okay. Let's go on.
His reverend tutors had at times a tussle, and for their Aeneids, Iliads, and Odysseys, were forced to make an odd sort of apology, for Donna Inez dreaded the mythology. Ovid's a rake, as half his verses show him. Anacreon's morals are a still worse sample. Catullus scarcely has a decent poem. I don't think Sappho's Ode a good example. Although Longinus tells us there is no hymn where the sublime soars forth on wings more ample. But Virgil's songs are pure. Except that horrid one beginning with Formosum Pastor Corydon.
Now, you have to explain that.
Well, that's a reference to Virgil's second Eclogue, And it's about the farmhand Corydon's homosexual passion for the boy Alexis.
Uh-huh.
So Cory and Alex in love is not exactly a classroom text in 19th century Britain.
I would say not. So now we get into the Christian saints. Go ahead.
Sermons he read and lectures he endured and homilies and lives of all the saints. To Jerome and to Chrysostom inured, he did not take such studies for restraints. But how faith is acquired and then insured, so well not one of the aforesaid paints as St. Augustine in his fine Confessions, which make the reader envy his transgressions.
Now, that's funny because the Confessions talk about all the bad things that he did. And that,
yeah, exactly.
Go ahead.
Yeah. This, too, was a sealed book to little Juan. I can't but say that his mamma was right, if such an education was the true one. She scarcely trusted him from out her sight. Her maids were old, and if she took a new one, you might be sure she was a perfect fright. She did this during even her husband's life. I recommend as much to every wife.
Now, let me ask you, will contemporary readers of a feminist bent find a lot of misogyny in Don Juan?
This is a loaded question because I don't want to unduly discourage readers who might have an ideological beef with the patriarchy. But Byron was nothing if not a lover of women. And he was actually a lover of strong women, of very forceful women. You know, many of his lovers were actually, you know, aristocratic women of means, women, independent women, educated women, smart women. And so, yes, probably, you know, in the course of this long poem about essentially a rake, about a guy who has, you know, 1,001 women, you know, you're bound to find something, but it's probably no worse than anything you'd find in Shakespeare or Milton.
That's fair enough. Let's hear one last passage from the poem, and this one's from close to the end of Canto One. And the tone is quite different, right?
Right. He's kind of waxing personal and serious about his disillusionment with his own very early, very extravagant literary fame.
Okay. Go ahead.
Ambition was my idol, which was broken before the shrines of sorrow and of pleasure. And the two last have left me many a token o'er which reflection may be made at leisure. Now, like Friar Bacon's brazen head, I've spoken. Time is, time was, time's past. A chymic treasure is glittering youth, which I have spent betimes, my heart in passion and my head on rhymes.
Okay, help us with that a little bit. Well, Friar Bacon, is that
right? Friar Bacon is a reference to a play by Shakespeare's contemporary Robert Greene. It's called Friar Bacon and Friar Bungay.
Hmm.
And Friar Bacon creates this head. And this head essentially says three things: time is, time was, time is past, and then it falls to the ground and shatters.
Mm-hmm. So basically he's saying he spent his youth in amorous adventures and passion and writing poetry.
Exactly.
Okay, go ahead.
What is the end of fame? 'Tis but to fill a certain portion of uncertain paper. Some liken it to climbing up a hill, whose summit, like all hills, is lost in vapor. For this, men write, speak, preach, and heroes kill, and bards burn what they call their midnight taper, to have, when the original is dust, a name, a wretched picture, and worse bust. What are the hopes of man? Old Egypt's king Cheops erected the first pyramid and largest, thinking it was just the thing to keep his memory whole and mummy hid. But somebody or other rummaging burglariously broke his coffin's lid. Let not a monument give you or me hopes, since not a pinch of dust remains of Cheops.
That's a brilliant rhyme.
Yeah. I think it's pronounced Cheops, but in Byron's sort of like, I'm English and this is how I pronounce it, I think that's, you know, how he wants us to pronounce it based on the rhyme with me hopes.
Yeah, makes sense. Go ahead.
But I, being fond of true philosophy, say very often to myself, alas, all things that have been born were born to die, and flesh which death mows down to hay is grass. You've passed your youth not so unpleasantly, and if you had it o'er again, 'twould pass. So thank your stars that matters are no worse, and read your Bible, sir, and mind your purse. But for the present, gentle reader and still gentler purchaser, the bard, that's I, must with permission shake you by the hand, and so your humble servant and goodbye. We meet again, if we should understand each other, and if not, I shall not try your patience further than by this short sample. 'Twere well if others followed my example.
That's a great way to end a sampler of Byron's Don Juan. But still gentle purchaser, the person who's buying the poem, is that who he's talking
That's
to?
That's who he's talking to. Byron was a best-selling poet. He was one of the best-selling writers of his time.
Uh-huh.
His works used to fly off the shelves. And he used to give offense and cause a scandal, and they ate it up. They couldn't get enough of him.
So he's saying, goodbye if you don't like me, but otherwise stick around?
Exactly. And these cantos came out sequentially. So it wasn't like suddenly on the shelves all 16 and a half cantos of Don Juan were just sitting there in a big stack. You know, each one would come out sequentially. And in order to dishearten all of us further, I think Byron knocked this out in about a couple months, actually.
You're kidding.
The whole canto one.
Wow.
Came out. Yeah. Yeah. He just did it. So that's easy. He had skills. That's, no one can deny that.
Yeah. But he famously never finished it. Why not?
He was a man of, you know, immense contradictions, and, you know, as a man, he was this debauched Scottish lord with money, women, and fame from the start, but he was also a fierce and genuine defender of revolutionary ideals, and unlike the other romantic poets, he put his money where his mouth was, and granted, he actually had the money to put there,
yeah.
But he ended up dying in his attempt to start a revolt among the Greeks against Turkish rule. Mm. He almost ended up being a kind of Lawrence of Ionia.
So he's sort of, sort of an early prototype for Lawrence of Arabia, and you mentioned in an email that he's sort of the James Bond of the 19th century, right?
You know, I think that there are a lot of really, really uncanny similarities between Byron and Bond, and this may be because I'm a Bond fanatic and a Byron fanatic, but really it's as though Byron sank into the collective unconscious and then reemerged over a century later through the pen of Ian Fleming. Because this is for real. Because look, Byron was a Scottish lord. We know this, right?
Right.
Bond was not only played, or you know, the role in the movies was originated by a Scottish actor, Sean Connery. But actually, in On Her Majesty's Secret Service, the novel, Bond, look at Freudian slip, Bond goes into his ancestry with one of the characters, and he talks to this character. He's saying that, look, my dad was Scottish. So Bond actually has Scottish blood himself. But it's not just that. There's also this suave exterior with danger below,
mm-hmm.
and there's phenomenal success with women. There's the wine, the taste for the finer things in life.
Right.
And there's also this notion of this kind of aristocratic, kind of, you know, suave man being a man of action at the same time. And Byron proved himself at the end to be a man of action.
But could James Bond write Out of Arima?
Probably not.
Yeah.
But Byron never took on Blofeld.
Right. He wouldn't have fared well with him. Amit, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Amit Majmudar's most recent book of poems is Heaven and Earth. His first novel, Partitions, came out in 2011, and his second, The Abundance, is coming out next year. And you can find copies of Don Juan in just about any secondhand bookstore in the country and your local library. And you can find samples of Don Juan on our website, poetryfoundation.org. Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.